We are at Vanderbilt University School of Law with Nita Farahani, who's a law professor and a philosophy professor here, and has a great interest in behavioral genetics and neuroscience. She came with a degree in genetics and cellular biology from Dartmouth College. There's a reason for reading all this out. A master's degree in biology from Harvard, a JD, MA, and a PhD in philosophy, biology, and jurisprudence at Duke. So you go across already a great number of disciplines. So it was not surprising when we arrived here a few days ago for the Law and Biosciences conference that you arranged to find that the topics, and there was an enormous binder, went across all of these subjects. It was a panel on decision making, enhancement and identity, agency and responsibility, panel on reproduction, panel on end of life, panel on discrimination. In addition to that, you had a book out which you edited recently called The Impact of Behavioral Sciences on Criminal Law, which talks about new discoveries in neuroscience and genetic predisposition and their use recently much more in criminal justice cases. This sounds like you've organized a quite definite package here that you think is an important thing to move forward in this direction and all these things together. How did that happen?
You make it sound a little bit more deliberate than it actually was, which is I started with a genuine interest in science, particularly in genetics. It was a growing field at the time when I was in college, and I was quite interested and intrigued by it. And the more time that I spent in the sciences, the more I realized that it was not a career as being a scientist that really interested me, but rather the intersections, the policy implications, the business applications, the bioethical applications that really mattered. And so that led me down a path of first feeling like I needed to have a greater background in science. And so I did the master's work in neuroscience and genetics. And in particular, I was much more interested in behavioral genetics than just the pure sort of forensic science. And then from there, issues naturally arose of what's going on in the legal system, how are these things regulated, how are these things being used, what are the ways we should be thinking about the legal system as we look at science. And then, of course, that leads you to the philosophical questions, because I think any of these conversations are incomplete without having a philosophical background and conversation about what the normative implications are. And so each of these different educational opportunities gave me a way to access the information and have a different perspective on it and understand that it's really an intersection of several different fields, and understanding the history of each of those fields and how this new technology will impact new thinking in those fields.
My assumption, which may be wrong, is that if you did that, and as you were going down this pathway and beginning to augment it as you went along, you must have been finding things wanting.
I did, yes.
What were the holes?
As I asked questions, I realized that people didn't really have answers to them, right? So I was interested in there was a class I took on behavioral genetics when I was at Harvard, which looked at twin studies, and one of the applications of the twin studies was somebody was studying violence and aggression and criminality. And so I started asking questions about, has this shown up in the legal system? And people really didn't have answers to that, about whether or not it had been used in the legal system and what the implications were for its use and what kind of meaning it had when we think about the normative background and history of the legal system. And so as I asked those questions and realized that there weren't the answers, I set out on gaining the education so that I could start to answer those questions. And it was really just my own personal desire to understand how these things came together that led me to realize that there was a real gap in understanding. So when I did my doctorate, I did it on the impact of behavioral genetics on criminal law, looking at it from both a scientific perspective as well as from the normative perspective and the philosophical implications in the criminal justice field, and saying, what does the science tell us, and does the science give us any information that's new? Even if the science does or does not give us that information, what's the background of the philosophical and criminal law implications that we have to be concerned about that may be challenged by this emerging science?
Yeah. Now, when we first met, I invited you to one of the meetings that the Science Network does called Beyond Belief, and we've done three of those so far. And we had some sections, this is your brain on law, this is your brain on money, the implication being within the organization as well there that we were paying a great deal of attention to the usefulness of burgeoning field of neuroscience studies, cognitive neuroscience studies, in these issues like decision making and so on and so forth. And indeed, this as we did this meeting this last week, I had with me a copy of Nature, or the editorial was Science in Court.
Right.
There was a big piece about magnetic resonance imaging, particularly about the use by Kent Keel in these cases of psychopathy.
Right.
There was stuff about fingerprinting, there was stuff about DNA and fingerprinting and so on and so forth. So you're absolutely on target here. It's quite clear. Another piece from the Trends in Cognitive Sciences by somebody fairly local here, Fred Schauer, on neuroscience, lie detection and the law, in which he was making the point that although there's some hesitation about the efficacy of fMRI, whether it's just pretty pictures, which are extremely seductive to a general audience, one of the reasons they're not usually allowed in court, nevertheless, as a piece of evidence, their level of reliability is at least as good as many of the things that are already admitted in court, so why not? But it's a very different argument from a scientific perspective, which is seeking this certitude almost, if you like, to saying, well, pragmatically, we should be doing this. And I found that during the conference, one of the major distinctions here was between the sort of the view from 30,000 feet of what theoretically the science could do and whether the science is right and science is wrong, to the people from the law who are saying, we've got people in court every day, need to make decisions. We've got to do this. We need to move on. So that was a rather long preamble to invite you to speculate on and talk about that area.
So that's a lot to unpack, and I'll start by looking at it from the scientific perspective. So it is right to say that there are real scientific questions about where are we heading with the types of studies that are being done, what have we learned from the types of studies that are being done. And before we even get to the relevance in law, we should ask the questions about what is it that we are studying and what kind of information have we gleaned from those. This is the reason why when I did my doctorate, the first half of it was really dedicated to a philosophy of biology approach to say what kinds of things can we draw and is it fair to make the conclusions that people are making from the scientific studies that are happening. Neuroscience is a very new field. I mean, it's an old field in some ways, but it's a new field in that we're asking new questions and making rapid and increasingly interesting discoveries every day in the field. But it is a field where there are very small studies, meaning that the number of subjects that are in each study are really quite small. The inferences that can be drawn right now are quite limited in that we don't have an adequate understanding right now of what a normal brain is, right? So to be able to look across the population and say, this person's brain looks very different, or this person has suffered trauma in this particular region of their brain, and that has X implication for what we can say scientifically about the person or medically about the person, we're limited right now. We're limited because we don't have a huge population of brains that we can draw from or brain scans that we can draw from to say, you know, statistically this varies quite a bit in this particular region of the brain, and therefore we know that, you know, this person acted in this particular way because of the anomalies in their brain. The science is new, it's exciting, there's a lot that we can hope for it to say, and yet we don't have a tremendous amount of background that we can draw from. So we take that, which is a field that is rapidly evolving and producing exciting results every day, and we look at the legal system, which is always, it seems, interested in finding new ways to provide objective evidence to answer age-old questions that we have. And the most popular, of course, in the first area in which this evidence has been introduced is criminal law, but that's just the beginning, right? So if we're talking about using evidence on behalf of an individual, so new brain studies that show this is how we can explain a person's behavior, it's going to show up in criminal law first, in part because the stakes are so high in criminal law. We're talking about people who have their liberty at stake, and so any new evidence that can help us in that decision-making process, people are anxious to introduce. But we see it rapidly being introduced in other areas of law as well. And in each area of law that we look at, we have to ask the question, first, what does the science tell us? But second, what is the background assumption with which we're working for in that area of law? And is this evidence relevant in light of the background assumptions that we're working with from that area of law?
One of the things that came up in conversations with some of your colleagues afterwards as well was this this difficulty of knowing whether a specific, should we say, signature of the neurocognitive architecture at any given moment from an fMRI, whether that actually constitutes, is what would be there at the time of the commission of a putative crime, and whether there, how you could possibly then extend, go from one to the other. And there's this concept in law, is there not, of mens rea as well, which means that you actually have to have an intent in mind, as it were, at the time to... Could you explain that and the difficulties with that?
So you were talking specifically about one particular use of neuroscience, which we've seen happen in cases. So in criminal cases, a particular defendant has been known to come into court and say, I have damaged the frontal lobe region of my brain. The frontal lobe region of the brain is responsible for executive function, for planning, for things like that. And the crime for which you have charged me is something like first-degree murder. And first-degree murder requires premeditation and planning. And so they say, look, because I have damage to this area of the brain, which is necessary for planning and for premeditation, it is difficult, if not impossible, for me to have planned and premeditated this crime. It's much more likely that the way that I acted was impulsive rather than premeditated and planned. The problem, of course, with neuroscience is we're looking after a crime has already been commissioned at a person's brain. They're not walking around with an fMRI machine hooked up to them at all times. And so if we want to know what was the person thinking at the exact moment that they committed the crime, we don't have that answer. Instead, we simply have some understanding of how their behavior generally works, some understanding about the general nature of their predispositions, and we can make a slightly more informed and educated, perhaps, guess at what their mental state was at the time of the crime. But that begs the question, what do we mean by mental state at the time of the crime? And is the scientific understanding of mental state the type of question that we are asking when we say, what was the person's mental state at the time of the crime? And it seems like maybe not.
There was also a problem I found in, and this is just terms of art to some extent, in the fact that the vocabularies, although they might use the same words, have different meanings now, or the meanings have evolved in specialized disciplines, so that these just giant big totem words like trust, or the self, or the individual, there's a sort of common sense, folk wisdom way of using these things, which tends to be what lawyers still employ, I think. Whereas you
so I disagree with you.
Oh, good.
I think that I thought you were actually going to say that the way that we use those words in common parlance, so the way that the layperson uses it, or even the way that an expert in a different field uses it, like a scientist, has a very particular meaning, and in law there's a very different meaning. And that, I think, is true, which is that lawyers use words to mean very specific things: trust, identity, personhood. They have a very different meaning in law than they do in something like a philosophical debate about free will. And when we look at those differences, we start to understand why some of this evidence may or may not be relevant to the fundamental questions that we're asking from a legal perspective rather than a philosophical or scientific perspective.
Well, in fact, we do agree. And that's the direction I was going to go in, because what I was talking about was, when you're talking about something like a self or its trust, for example, you might be using language in neuroscience where you're talking about the construction of representational networks and so on. It has a different construal to it, and sometimes I felt like there was a barrier between the two disciplines. But maybe that's just going to go. That's just time. That's just that'll be just familiarity and so on.
Well, so I agree that there's a barrier. Part of the reason why I wanted to have the educational background in each of these areas is because it seems like people don't always realize from different disciplines that they're using the same words in very different ways. Yeah. And so a lot of the conversation can end up stalled because they can't access the same vocabulary when they are using it to have such different meanings. And so I try to serve as a role sometimes of a translator, right, which is to use the meaning behind the word rather than the tag of the word in order to be able to have a richer and more meaningful conversation across disciplines.
Yeah, when I started and you said that I made it sound like it was more of a contrived enterprise that you were undertaking, it still sounds to me, forgive me, it just still sounds like a mission, great mission, wonderful mission, but something that you've quite clearly decided needs fixing.
So, I mean, I agree with you in the sense that now I am on that mission. But when I started and went down this educational path, it was really just a passion to understand and master a particular area without the intention of necessarily becoming a legal academic or somebody who was weighing in on public policy issues in this area. It was instead really quite intentionally simply to understand and master these different areas and to answer questions that I personally had. As I began to answer those questions, I realized that there was this gap and that perhaps the best thing for me to do would be to try to fill that gap and to serve in the role of trying to bring together these different disciplines. And it just so happened through serendipity that at the same time that I converged on all of these different fields, there was a genuine interest in many different communities to understand this intersection and to start to explore it.
Okay, so how did you get into this in the first place? Is there some contextual background here, family influences, parents in science in any way?
So my father is a cardiologist, and so I grew up with an interest in science and talking about science at home and really engaging in a lot of dialogue about the state of healthcare, for example, or the state of different new technologies that were emerging and what the implications of those technologies were. So this was dinner time conversation with my father, and really started out thinking that the only way to explore that interest was in medicine and to become a physician. And it was as I began to look for different internship opportunities or different opportunities to explore my interest in genetics that I realized that there were a lot of different ways that you can have a career that looks at scientific issues and not necessarily by being a physician.
I assume from the name Farahani that this... were you born here?
I was born here, yes.
Your family is Iranian.
Yes, my parents were born in Iran, and my father came here to do his medical residency. My mother came over a year later after she was finished with her nursing education, and my father had planned with my mother to return to Iran, but they came over at the end of the 60s, and then by the time they were planning on going back, it was the beginning of the Iranian Revolution. And so they were waiting to see if things would blow over, because at that time it just seemed like there was some unrest, and things have not quite blown over yet.
So. No, not exactly. So do you still take an interest? There is an interest, do you have a particular interest in politics and international affairs? And I'm just wondering if that also derived from the...
Particular in that I am engaged and interested in it, and obviously interested in what's happening in Iran and happening in the Middle East and worldwide. But I'd say, no more particular than having a genuine interest in following it. I haven't been that engaged in international affairs, for example.
But policy issues. I mean, yeah. As you know, that we concentrate on issues at the intersection of science and social policy. I could obviously sit down and talk with people who are quite focused in just driving ahead on bench work or so on, or right. on niceties of constitutional decisions. I mean, how this situates itself in society is something that I would think, from having read these books and the papers and the way in which you assemble groups, that you must have this overlap going on all the time.
Overlap with international law or overlap with policy?
With policy.
So I think it's interesting the kind of distinctions that you drew, because one of the things that I encourage scientists to realize is that even a bench scientist, that there are significant policy implications of their work, and that every person in each field needs to recognize that there is a bigger social context in which they're doing their work, and that their interests may play out. And so whether you're a bench scientist or a legal academic or an attorney or a philosopher, all of that, I think, converges ultimately on how it affects the world, and whether that is the world, your smaller political niche or the broader international community. I think it's important to recognize that, especially in this area, which is scientific advance, there are tremendous policy implications of that work.
Sure, but I mean, and I would subscribe to that, and I would wish that every scientist I ever sat down and talked to thought that way.
Right.
But it sometimes takes quite a bit of pushing, because their interest is pragmatically getting a grant.
So it,
which
it,
is a pretty cutthroat business out there.
Yeah, it's in part interest in pragmatically getting a grant, and in part it's a fear of their work being politicized. Right, so we have a history in this country of seeing scientific research being put to different policy ends that the scientists don't always agree with or not even fully engaged with. And so I think there is both a different focus, which is the pragmatic focus of advancing their own scientific research, but also a fear about what it means to be politically engaged, what it means to have a voice, what it means to their research and how their research can be characterized and mischaracterized. And what I encourage scientists to do is recognize that they can drive that, right? So to the extent that they stay out of it, it's more likely that their work will be mischaracterized, or more likely that they won't have a voice or an active ability to influence the way in which scientific research is used and directed, rather than staying out of the policy-making process. I think they really need to get engaged to ensure that it satisfies their interests.
Well, of course, the elephant in the room there, or the giant primate in the room there, would be the way in which there is still this ongoing debate, particularly in this country, mm-hmm. about Darwinism and evolution and natural selection and creation and this conflict between science and religion. Is that something that ever came into your household? Come from a religious background? Was there?
No. So we come from a background where I think my family is quite spiritual, but religion wasn't a dominant part of the conversations that we had.
When we talked at the Beyond Belief meetings, which you attended, one of the other participants was Sam Harris.
Yes.
Sam has gone on to get a PhD in neuroscience, is still, however, very much at the forefront of Project Reason. Mm-hmm. And injecting, I think what he hopes is reason into rationality, into the whole debate about religion as well.
Yeah.
And he gave a talk at TED, the TED conference, recently, and as a result of that, posted a much longer post on his Project Reason website, because there was a TED talk is only 80 minutes, you can't cover the universe.
Right.
And there were lots of critiques, people liking it for the wrong reasons and disliking it for the wrong reasons, from what I read here. But he did mention that he took issue with a number of things that Sean Carroll had said. Sean has also been on the Science Network, had a book out recently, From Eternity to Here.
Yeah.
And there were lots of things about is and ought and Humean.
Yeah, cause and effect.
Hair splitting and so on, and whether you can in fact derive a moral framework from science. Which, you know, people still think that there are these two separate magisteria, as Stephen Jay Gould used to say. I mean, we have a director of the National Institutes of Health now, Francis Collins, who has written and is well known to be a very religious person, has written books on all these sorts of things as well.
Yeah.
Sam has taken issue with him as well. But there was a point here where he seemed to be referring to an encounter at Beyond Belief. And it says here, at the conclusion of my talk, he was at a scientific meeting, I fell into debate with another invited speaker who seemed at first glance to be very well positioned to reason effectively about the implications of science for our understanding of morality. She holds a degree in genetics from Dartmouth, a master's in biology from Harvard, and a law degree, another master's, and a PhD in the philosophy of biology from Duke.
So that might be me.
Sounds like you, doesn't
right.
it? The scholar is now a recognized authority in the intersection between criminal law, genetics, neuroscience, and philosophy. That's true. Here's a snippet of our conversation, more or less verbatim, and I don't know where this came from, perhaps you can tell me. She, what makes you think that science will ever be able to say that forcing women to wear burqas is wrong? Me, Sam, because I think that right and wrong are a matter of increasing or decreasing well-being, and it's obvious that forcing half the population to live in cloth bags and beating or killing them if they refuse is not a good strategy for maximizing human well-being. She, but that's only your opinion. Me, okay, let's make it even simpler. What if we found a culture that ritually blinded every third child by literally plucking out his or her eyes at birth? Would you then agree that we'd found a culture that was needlessly diminishing human well-being? She, it would depend on why they were doing it. me slowly returning my eyebrows from the back of my head. Let's say they were doing it on the basis of religious superstition. In their scripture, God says, every third must walk in darkness. She, then you could never say that they were wrong. Such opinions are not uncommon in the ivory tower. I was talking to a woman, it's hard not to feel that her gender makes her views all the more disconcerting, who just delivered an entirely lucid lecture on the moral implications of neuroscience for the law, which is on Beyond Belief website. She was concerned that our intelligence services might one day use neuroimaging technology for the purposes of lie detection, and so on and so on and so on and so forth. So he says, while listening to her talk, as yet unaware of her liberal views on compulsory veiling and ritual enucleation, I thought her slightly overcautious, but a basically sane and eloquent authority on the premature use of neuroscience in our courts. I confess that once we did speak and I peered into the terrible gulf that separated on these issues, I found that I could not utter another word to her. In fact, our conversation ended with my blindly enacting two neurological cliches. My drawer quite literally dropped open and I spun on my heels before walking away.
Sounds like an interesting reaction.
It does. When did that happen? Because that wasn't in the meeting, was it?
No. I dimly recall having a conversation with him, and if I remember correctly, it was about a two-minute conversation as we were boarding a bus to go to dinner that evening, where obviously we didn't have an opportunity to truly explore both of our views on this issue.
The reason I bring this up is that I thought, having done Beyond Belief 1, which was created an enormous amount of interest, obviously, and then Beyond Belief 2, Beyond Belief 3, that we'd, you know, pretty much done it. There was the new atheists were in the ascendant, the four horsemen were riding, and so on, and it went on and so on. But I thought we'd kind of dealt with the issue, but it appears not, because
dealt with this which is issue?
The issue of whether of the science versus religion thing that you don't want to talk about. But I want to go beyond that.
Yeah.
And say that this is founded on something else, and this gets into the philosophy area and the theology area. And the reason I think it hasn't gone away, I just picked up a copy of the Philosopher's Magazine, this current one, which is talking about beyond the new atheism, the new stage in the God debate.
I take Sam's view to be one that's a lot broader than just religion. It's about morality generally.
Yeah.
This is an area that I'd say Beyond Belief 4 potentially could explore in greater detail, because I think
this is where I'm going to, because I'm trying to figure out. Having said that, we obviously there's still something out there.
Right.
What do you think we should tackle next?
Well, so, you know, when I say that I am not willing to really talk about religion, it's because first I think there are people who are better positioned to have the conversation with you about evolutionary biology and some religious issues, which is not really my area of scholarship. But moral reasoning, moral thinking, the differences between potentially theoretical concepts of morality and legal concepts of culpability, these are really rich and interesting conversations to have. And the conversation that I had with Sam is a little bit telling of the gulf between people who focus in one area versus another one, versus a kind of, you know, multidisciplinary perspective. So, my conversation with Sam got at the point that I think that biology alone will not be able to tell us what are essentially normative questions. And it's true that we can, perhaps to Sam's credit, look at issues like what does diminishment mean or what does enhancement mean. But ultimately, I think those are also normative questions rather than purely biological ones. And it'll be difficult to do things like measure happiness and well-being and be able to have objective measures of those when they're normative concepts about what do we want our society to look like? What do we think is the ultimate measure of happiness and thriving?
Yeah. So let me go to this Philosopher's Magazine. There's a piece in here by Ronald Aronson on the phony war, he calls it, between science and religion. Some interesting points he raises in here, which I think go much more in the direction you want to talk about. And he says, in the United States at least, most ordinary citizens would tend to agree when asked by the most recent Pew survey where they get their ideas of right and wrong. 29% answered religious teachings and beliefs. Mm-hmm. While 5% looked most for guidance to scientific information, but the largest number, 61%, saw themselves standing on somewhat less substantial ground, choosing either philosophy and reason, 9%, or practical experience and common sense, 52%. These figures suggest that the vast majority of Americans have a clear sense of the role played by human thought in reaching moral conclusions, that is, norms of right and wrong exist without being sanctioned by divine authority or science. He then goes on to talk about the fact that Francis Collins, as I mentioned, is now running NIH, despite having written a book on the, called The Language of God, which was, you know, pretty severely indicted by Sam Harris, who doesn't think that somebody with those views should be running and giving out grants based on science. And then this person suggests that that one of the reasons that Collins is actually there is not that he's was appointed precisely because of his religious views, and that it's an attempt possibly to appoint somebody who's both a scientist and a highly public believer, and the administration might have seen that as a way of reconciling science and religion. I don't know whether that's true or not. Yeah. But so this whole notion of common sense, people having these views of what's right and wrong, and by extension apparently assembling a morality as they navigate through their social lives, rather than having some rigid set of rules that they adhere to, seems to be more the point, and that's the area that you are comfortable in working in, right? Is that?
I mean, tangentially. So I'd say first, an interesting area of exploration in the fields of neuroscience and in the kind of intersection between law and neuroscience and philosophy are questions of what is morality, right? And you've given an example where people, when polled, don't have a clear answer of where their own individual sense of morality comes from, right? Is it religious teaching? Is it something that's innate? Is it something that they've gained through their own practical thought and reasoning? Neuroscientists are trying to locate that in the brain to see, you know, are there, for example, universal truths? Just like there's some concept through Chomsky, right, that there's a universal grammar that underlies language. Many people are exploring the question of, is there some things that across cultures, across time, our shared sense of what's right and what's wrong, and is that something that is innate, that's hardwired into the brain? And, you know, that is one perspective, right, which is it perhaps is the case that if we see a lot of different cultures, a lot of different religions, a lot of different, you know, people across history and across time sharing similar beliefs and values, that perhaps it is, you know, essential for human thriving, and that's the reason why people choose to adopt those standards and those norms, and that perhaps even we can understand religion that way as having, you know, being motivated by some innate values. I don't know what the answers to those questions are, right? So I don't know how good the science is in that area. These are, of course, issues that we've grappled with historically. We've grappled with since the, you know, beginning of time of what is religion, what is morality, to what extent is it actually innate versus something that is externally taught in a social construct. The area that I'm working on a little bit more is to try to ask one particular question, right? So I can't solve this entire huge debate, but I can look to start to understand what's the difference in the grammar that we have between moral responsibility. So I'm interested in just that one particular question. I mean, I'm interested in other questions generally, but I'm studying and trying to grapple with and unpack what is moral responsibility, and is there a difference between our concepts of responsibility in an area like philosophy, in an area like neuroscience or the scientific community generally, versus our concept in law, or is there a similar idea that underlies all of them?
So why don't you at least, so tell me what you mean by moral responsibility.
So we blame and stigmatize people for acts that they do. An example is, you know, if I go and drive my car after having several glasses of wine, and I do so in a manner that risk danger to other people, is that something that is a morally blameworthy act, such that you would say, you know, I think that you are a bad person, somebody that I can stigmatize and say that you have done something wrong, quite apart from whether or not a police officer has ever arrested me and, you know, done a breathalyzer, and quite apart from whether or not I've actually committed a legal wrong by driving under the influence or harming any other person. And that question of, you know, to what extent is a person responsible for their acts, and to what extent can we blame and stigmatize them from their acts, may have different meanings in philosophy and in neuroscience than it does in law. And that issue is one that I'm trying to unpack and to try to come up with a theory that might actually unify both. My view is that we've been talking about a concept of freedom, and in legal decision making, people say the concept of free will is an empty one and one that doesn't matter very much. And the people in philosophy and in science say the concept of free will matters quite a bit. If we can't show that a person has true control over their conduct, right? If we can show that there is a scientific basis for the reason that a person acted the way that they did, then you can't assign to them blame, responsibility, and stigma. And likewise, in law, you shouldn't be assigning to them blame, responsibility, and stigma. And my view is that there may be a richer concept that we're using in law for freedom, and that that concept is one that allows us to find people both legally responsible as well as morally responsible.
Okay, but let me just play devil's advocate and use an absolutely basic and rather crass formulation, which is that, I mean, if you don't have the concept of freedom of will, I mean, this all turns out to be a can of worms, doesn't it? I mean, how can you run a system without...
Well, that's my point, which is, so in law, people have taken a compatibilist approach, which is to say that even if we were to find that a person, that we could explain their behavior based on their brain or their genes or their environment, nevertheless, there would still be a good consequentialist reason for holding them responsible, which is they have in fact committed a criminal act, and it is necessary for us to have a functioning society and to protect the general welfare of society, and that to do so, we have to choose to hold certain people responsible, which may mean incarcerating them, which may mean treating them, which may mean punishing them. Whatever it is, there may be a good consequentialist reason for holding people responsible. And scientists and philosophers often throw their arms up and say, you know, that's crazy, right? If we can actually show that a person isn't free, then you can't assign blame, responsibility, and stigma to that person. And I think that there is more than just a hard compatibilist approach that we could take in law, which is to say that there is a difference between freedom of choice and freedom of action. If a person has the ability to act freely and identify with their actions, then that is both a sufficient basis to hold them morally responsible as well as legally responsible.
Okay, now you think about these things all the time, philosophers do, but I mean just for a general audience as well, a utilitarian position, a consequentialist position, how do you deal with the problem that when do you end the sum of consequences? When do you say that you've finally reached the end of all the possible consequences and therefore are able to make a decision?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, people have rich theories of utilitarianism that help them answer these questions. I draw more from utilitarianism and consequentialism and moral philosophy than I have developed a full theory of utilitarianism, but of course that's one of the biggest objections to utilitarianism is which cost do you count, right? If utilitarianism is about the greatest good for the greatest number of people, how do we count what the benefits of the system are versus what the negative attributes of the system are, the costs. And most people would say that the most direct costs, the ones that you can measure, and the most direct benefits are the ones that should be included, and very remote benefits and very remote costs are difficult to attribute to the choice that you've made. And so you have to draw the line at ones that are high probability and most directly related rather than low probability and least directly related to the issue that you've resolved.
So how do you contrast with the, again, I'm just getting a sort of political justice 101 from you, which is great. The whole notion of a veil of ignorance and this attempt to sort of deal with distributive justice issues and so on. Could you put that into context as well with this?
Yeah, I mean, in the abstract, it's harder, right? I mean, so there is, the concept of operating from behind the veil of justice and also having moral absolutes that might underlie a more categorical approach like Rawls would take. And that can be consistent with the utilitarian approach, right? You don't have to have a pure one approach versus the other approach. You can say, there are limitations and we can understand those limitations through the lens of Rawls. There are different models that you can approach. So, an example would be We could look at the criminal justice system as being a purely utilitarian system, where we're just simply trying to maximize the best possible outcomes, or we could look at it as a system of justice, right? And we think that perhaps retributivism is the appropriate thing to be using as our metric of justice. And retributivism would say you have to use punishment that is commensurate with the crime that the person has committed, the harm that they've inflicted on society, as well as their own personal moral culpability, and that retributivism is a required response from society, right? So you'd say, if somebody has committed a harm against society, then society has not just the right, but the obligation to respond with punishment. And that's a different approach than utilitarianism, which would say, if it isn't effective, if it doesn't increase the good or general welfare for the people to have a response, then there's no need for society to respond to every potential harm that's inflicted upon it. And these are competing values, but they can also be complementary values. You really need to draw, I think, from multiple different theories of punishment and justice in order to have a system that really reflects societal values.
Another approach that is out there at the moment that people may have heard of, a new book by Amartya Sen called The Idea of Justice, the capabilities approach that he and Martha Nussbaum have espoused.
I haven't explored that much. I can't really comment on it.
But again, these are looking. They bring. Seems to me that they introduce social concerns in different degrees rather than abstract counting of pain and pleasure. So it's difficult to figure all these. The reason I mention this and why there are all these different competing theories out there is that, and the stuff about the neuroscience as well, what do you know about fMRI, what do you know about DNA? I would have thought that it must be a nightmare to be a judge and wonder if you know enough to be a judge. And yet then I'll hear people saying, well, judges don't think about these sorts of things. They're dealing with common sense. It's an accumulated wisdom, which a neuroscientist would look at you and an evolutionary biologist would look at you and say, well, what's this wisdom thing?
Right.
So there are these very different standards of how to assess somebody's behavior.
I think a lot of the deeper and more theoretical questions are not necessarily ones that judges are facing on a daily basis. And you might think that the place that you should be more focused is on the legislature, right? Because they're having to decide what policies and laws they're going to actually pass that are commensurate with what we know about behavior and what we know about how people respond. So, for example, if you knew that, based on science, that a particular type of punishment rather than having a net positive effect on society has a net negative effect. So, for example, suppose we discovered that if you incarcerate a particular type of offender, they are much more likely to become recidivist offenders, repeat offenders when they come out of prison. You would think perhaps that the legislature would look at that evidence and they'd say maybe the better answer to this particular type of population is to have a different kind of sentence. Judges are dealing with it on a much more individual and granular basis, right? So they may see an individual case where fMRI is being introduced for the first time, and they're having to serve a gatekeeping role, right, to decide whether or not this scientific evidence can be admitted into the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And that can be quite challenging because they are presented with evidence that they may not have great familiarity with, competing experts who are trying to help a particular side develop their case for why it should be admitted or should be excluded, and the judge having to sit as an arbiter as to whether or not the scientific evidence has reached a legal standard of admissibility. And that's a challenge for them, but one that I think judges are up for, given that they are constantly seeking new education. I teach at a number of seminars for neuroscience for judges, where they're taught the basics of neuroscience, they're taught how this evidence is being introduced, they're actively engaged in shaping it. But I say all that with the caveat of there is a limited role for judges in this entire debate. They're just one part of the overall policy response that will happen, and it will happen from the legislative branch, it'll happen from the executive branch. Judges play just one part in deciding how this evidence will go forward.
There was some discussion, though. I think this was a conversation with Owen Jones, who's obviously professor of law and of biology here at Vanderbilt, papers that he's been working on with René Marois, who's in psychology. And one of the things that they were contemplating looking at is to see what was going on in terms of neural activity when people are making decisions. Possibly can expertise be increased there? Can you find people who have areas of the brain that are more active, and does that correspond with people who are great decision makers, and what is their track record of doing? So in other words, looking for signatures that sort of suggest, I'm not suggesting there's a kind of a Solomon module, but...
Well, I mean, I think the example you give is a wonderful one, which brings me back to the point of normative decisions can't be answered by science, right? So this research, suppose it shows that somebody has greater activity in a particular area of the brain. We still normatively have to decide what's the best model for decision making in the legal system. Is it a cross-section of people who have a lot of activity in a particular area of a brain and less activity in that particular area of the brain because it's more representative of the people? Is it that we think that there's greater impartiality and we think that's a value that we wish to maximize when people have a particular area of their brain that are activated? And so that normative decision-making is something that is quite apart from whatever science may reveal. We still have to decide what we think society would best look like. And then if we can find scientific evidence to help us effectuate those decisions, all the better. If we can't, we can't, right? So it isn't that science will necessarily drive the ultimate outcomes. We have to make the normative choices that science may help us effectuate eventually.
Evidence-based decisions. I mean, one of the other great joys of being at Vanderbilt is that you can walk across to the Peabody campus and you'll find the best, what some people have counted the best education school in the country as well. And
yes.
We happen to be here at a time when Tennessee and Delaware both were selected to receive awards and in this education stimulus, the Race to the Top prizes.
Okay.
I had some correspondence, and obviously you know that I work in the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, so we're very much interested in the whole notion of the science of educating.
Right.
And most of the debate has been on what builds a better teacher. My particular interest in this is to rephrase the question, so that obviously it's important to have great teachers, but how do you build better learners? What we know from the neuroscience and other things that will enhance people's ability, kids' ability to learn more effectively. And I noticed that in a correspondence with a couple of people here that Delaware seemed to have focused, the reason it was rewarded is it had a very excellent data system for figuring out where and quickly, how early things were going wrong. They had a great data system, allowed them to identify students who are at risk for dropping out of school based on actual past data on main predictors of high school dropout. If you've failed a grade, there's a 75% chance of dropping out. If you fail two grades, that goes up to 95%. If there's literacy or math problems, this is something I talked to Camilla Benbow about, that math and science, particularly math tests, are tremendous predictors of how people are going to do. So getting some sensible metrics into all of this is part of what the administration has said that it wants to do. In other words, have an evidence-based system operational.
Yeah.
This is an indication of it. Now, that leads me to talk about the administration, to talk about President Obama and his inaugural address and his talk to the National Academy of Sciences, where he said that one of the tasks of his administration was to restore science to its rightful place. He didn't give any coordinates.
Right.
This is an important watershed year as well in science. It's the 350th anniversary of the foundation of the Royal Society.
Right.
It's longest running instantiation of Francis Bacon's ideas of a scientific community. So, I'm wondering if you've formulated if you have an answer to that question. Since you go across these disciplines, you see it situated in a societal canvas. I mean, what do you think is the rightful place of science?
It's a very difficult question. I appreciate and echo the administration's view that science is an essential part of society, and that we can look at society and see that without scientific progress, that an entire nation is unlikely to progress, and the entire world is unlikely to progress, and that it is an essential part of the characteristic of any government and any community and society. So I'd say it is an essential part of community. It is a part that we should focus enormous attention and efforts on, but not at the exclusion of other areas. So it goes hand in hand. We can't expect that science is going to answer for us some of the most difficult questions that we have, difficult questions of morality and ethics and virtue. Those are questions that we as a society have to recognize go hand in hand with scientific research. And so I think the rightful place is one that is elevated, one that is accorded significant attention, and one that doesn't take preeminence over other equally important areas that go hand in hand with progress in society.
It's very interesting. Now,
Let me build on that for one moment.
Sure.
Some of the conversations that you were part of this past weekend
talked
about different views of essentialism, right? So genetic essentialism, neuroessentialism, etc. And that is a problem not just in a particular area of science, but in science generally, right? So I'd say scientific essentialism is just as much of a problem as any particular area. So to define those areas, genetic essentialism is the idea that our genes somehow have a greater influence and should be given accorded greater weight than any other influence on our behavior or any other influence on diseases, etc. Likewise for neuroscience, right? The idea that it's all localized in our brain. If we could simply unpack the brain and get into that black box, we'd suddenly have discovered the answer to the universe. And I think it isn't that simple, and I think the idea of scientific essentialism is just as concerning, which is to say, if we had the answers to science, if we could unpack human nature, if we could unpack nature generally, we'd have answers to all of the hard questions we've been grappling with in life, like what is personhood, and what is agency, and what is identity, and what are morality and ethics and virtue, what's the role of religion in society. These are hard questions that science can't answer alone. It may be that science gives us some new insights, but it's just one part of overall societal advance and overall progress.
Right, but there we are back to those the problem with those words and the different usages.
Well, each of them gives the idea that we privilege what is objective versus what is subjective, and I'd say we can't think that somehow science is objective in a way that normative decision making isn't. Right? It isn't any more objective. It is another field. It's another angle. It gives us one more perspective on human behavior and nature and society. But the difficult questions aren't going to be answered by science alone.
But why would you need anything more than, as Pat Churchin would put it, constraint, satisfaction, problems being solved to end up with a system of virtue ethics and a system of morality?
Well, I mean, so if I can see that when you are making a moral decision, a particular area of your brain is activated, and that everyone, when facing a particular decision, say it's the decision whether or not to punish someone, a particular area of their brain is activated, that doesn't answer for us whether or not punishment is appropriate, punishment is good, the model of punishment that we have chosen is going to maximize human welfare, because we have to first say, what do we mean by human welfare? What are the values that we wish to maximize in society? And if we can localize it in the brain or localize it in the gene or understand the genetic and neurological components to what is human nature and what is human behavior, then we have one more factor that we can take into account in trying to come up with what we think will maximize the values we wish to maximize. But that conversation isn't one that's answered by science. It's one that's answered by normative discussion and thought.
One of the things that I asked people, I've been asking people over the last few days, is that their views on all of these things, judges' views, teachers' views, educators' views, one assumes they must be predicated on some model of the mind or some model of human nature that these people who are making decisions have instantiated and that they are using as their...
Right.
But these vary. There aren't
No, that's right. I mean, there are some people who believe that, you know, we should understand humans and everything else in society simply as machines, and that they are predetermined machines that are playing out, you know, the causal determination of the universe. And therefore, the concept of responsibility is an empty one because every action can be explained by every causal factor that came before it. And to ascribe responsibility to some concept of agency or self or person, it is an artificial construct that we've created. That's a model that somebody could take, which would then color, of course, their views about all of these things. And they might say, the key to understanding everything is to understand the causes. If we can understand all of the causes, then we have the complete answer, and we can descriptively explain why things are the way they are. The idea of normative decision making is an empty one in that kind of universe. And obviously, I'm operating from a slightly different perspective, which is that we can understand that there are natural causes that precede actions doesn't answer for us whether we assign values to those actions or not. Those are normative decisions that I think we have the capability to make. So even if we come to the conclusion that none of us are free, we will continue to operate as if we are, and I think that that is a valuable thing to understand and to operate within that construct and constraint.
Okay, just unpack two words for me, if you wouldn't mind, because I hear them used differently in different disciplines. One is the word normative.
Yes.
And the other is this term of art, agency.
Yes.
So could you just put them into a...
Sure. So descriptive means that you are describing the world without assigning any value to it. Normative means that it is not the is, but is the ought, right? So this is the way things ought to be. We can understand moral thought as being either, right? So some people may say moral decision-making is nothing more than descriptive is of what's happening in the brain and instantiation of the brain versus a normative approach, which is to say this is positing how things ought to be. And the question is, where do we get that ought from? Is that ought something that is predetermined? Is that ought something that we are actively taking part in shaping? So that gets us to agency, right? Which is, if you have the idea that you are a machine, that you have no control over your actions and it's all predetermined, you would say you are not an agent of action. Instead, you are a product of causes. By contrast, you could say that if you believe that decisions and actions emanate from some aspect of you, something that you identify with, then we could say it is your agency that is bringing something about. And you might say, you know, if I have a reflex, right, to raise my hand, you knock my hand and I raise it, that might not arise from my agency. But if I decide to raise my hand to ask a question, that is an agent-driven action because I am consciously deciding to raise my hand, and I am effectuating that decision through the actions that I take.